I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. Hey, everybody. It's your host, Jason Klom. I just wanted to do a quick introduction because I don't know if I did a proper one when we recorded this, because we recorded it in chunks several weeks ago at the Writers Guild Foundation. My guest this week is Hillary Sweat. She is the archivist at the Writers Guild Foundation. I got in contact with her because, from what I understood, she had some material of Bob Booker of The First Family, and You Don't Have to Be Jewish, and just a ton of comedy albums. There's more comedy albums than most people, and with Earl Dowd and with other people. And she does have some of his stuff, but she was pretty clear, none of the stuff that would necessarily be interesting to me if I'm digging into comedy album history. So, but she did say, why don't you come in and see what I do have, and I'll show you around. Turns out the one writer she wanted, she's very interested in, is Mel Tolkien from Your Show of Shows. And the stuff I got to look at, including a demo version of a 45 they did end up releasing of two songs from that show. So there's plenty of great, wonderful stuff to look at, and there's stuff to look at there in general. They don't really necessarily give like behind the scenes tours or anything, unless you're a weirdo like me asking way too many questions, but their library is open to the public. You can go read just tons of scripts, leather bound scripts, some of which are from the collections of people who have done the show before. There's all kinds of great stuff. So I'm so excited. I was so excited about meeting her. And I think 5 minutes into it, I was like pretty ready to like work there and volunteer there, just be there all the time. Because even though it's not comedy album centric, it is definitely writer centric, but so many comedy writers, have their stuff there. There are typewriters and stuff, that were like, for instance, I got to see we probably talk about this, so I apologize, but I got to see the typewriter on which the story that the movie Psycho was based, was written. So that's a long way around to say that the story Psycho that the movie was based on, it was written on this typewriter. There's just all kinds of amazing things, and we concentrate a bit on Mel Tolkien, but we also talk about the work of archiving, and because that is something I'm fascinated with, something I'm digging into a little. You'll know from my past guests, some delightful, amazing guests like Taylor Jessen from Fireside Theater, Christopher Bay from Shelley Berman and Woody Woodbury's archives. And we've got other archivists coming up as well, but I wanted to talk generally about archiving, and there's going to be more episodes like that coming up. And I just thought it'd be fun to talk to somebody who does this from, she's got, a librarian, education. And so that's where a lot of this comes from. She's also a film person. She's got a film background, but, she has a more traditional archive path, than a lot of the people that I speak with, because a lot of people I speak with are fans who then become archivists who are maybe even amateurs at cleaning this stuff up. Or cataloging it, and then they get recruited or, you know, get in there and they become the primary person. But I wanted to speak to somebody who does this in a different way, and this is their day job, and it became very fascinating, and there's going to be a lot more to dig into as this show goes on, because I'm very interested in preserving comedy history just as much as I am just talking about it and listening to old comedy albums. This is a very long way to say enjoy this episode at the Writers Guild Foundation in Beverly Hills, California.
Well, it's kind of fun being able to actually see a pile of jokes.
Yeah, and how they're organized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how they're organized by subject.
So yeah.
It really appeals to me.
This is Mel Tolkien. He's the Your Show of Shows guy. He's one of my favorites, one of the best collections. Mm-hmm.
What size sample is this? Is it massive, the whole thing?
Well, the thing is that the scripts are voluminous, and there's many of them
sure.
for any given show. And so, aside from that, I mean, those are always 90% of a collection, and then, or, you know, 75%, I guess, give or take. And then the rest of it is the other stuff, the ephemera. This is just our little vault. This space was a bank.
Okay.
Originally, when the WGA moved into this building and bought this building in 96, and then 2004, 2005, our foundation did a capital campaign and built these offices and turned this, well, this was storage for a long time, but now it's climate controlled and secure and locked door, and there's shelves kind of, and it's kind of full in here, but So this is all audio visual. I don't know what is happening. And these are all periodicals.
Uh-huh.
Audio visual. Mostly it's all events that we've recorded over the years.
Okay.
So
okay.
I'm trying to get that under control. And periodicals. And then these are, this is some unproduced scripts and then three-dimensional artifacts like typewriters and awards.
Holy cow.
Mostly typewriters and awards.
I guess. That's amazing.
Yeah. And then these are like rare books, old books, signed books, just fragile, falling apart, a variety of like reasons that it's in the back here,
uh-huh.
not in the library. And then what's at the end? Just oversized scripts. And that's a collection that another volunteer is working on. And then collections. And so like all these boxes are A to Z,
mm-hmm.
while the right side is just, I don't know, it's more Writers Guild. Like institutional memory. And then this side is like the individual writers, manuscript collections, but it's like one or two boxes for each person, and then the rest
mm-hmm.
is like off site because it's like the entirety of Chico and the Man. Like, I don't need to keep that here.
No,
I don't
right.
have space for it. We're
mm-hmm.
full up in the library, and you know, I'm gonna be full up here anytime.
Right.
So, oh, Stan Burns, that's the other guy I was trying to think of. He was a Get Smart guy.
Mm hmm.
So, yeah, this is, it's people,
mm-hmm.
it's people back here, the ghosts
uh-huh.
of many writers, most of whom are
How long have people been donating things, though? How long, sorry, have people been donating stuff?
Well, are you recording?
I'm recording, yeah.
No, that's fine,
Yeah, I figured it would be, we're getting into the meat of it.
I'm in my element now. So our library has existed. It started, and it's small, and it's grown over the years. Since 1984, I think, is when they officially started it.
Okay.
And it was, like, for members only, and it was just kind of, we're collecting WGA award-winning scripts.
Okay.
And it was very, you know, top level, like, what are the most important scripts we should have?
Sure.
And at some point, well, and then in the 90s, and it was only open 3 days a week to begin with.
Okay.
And then in the 90s, we got open 5 days a week. And they hired a professional librarian and just have grown more and more over the years. And at some point in the late 90s, I think people started dying and getting old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the wives or the children would say, do you want this stuff? And...
Mm-hmm.
And the librarian would take it in, and she wasn't able to process, what we call process,
sure.
a lot of it. But there is this idea now I'm like being educational. There is this idea that I learned in grad school called benign neglect, where if you don't throw something away, if you're just like keeping it,
mm-hmm.
it's okay.
Yeah.
It's not, and paper lasts for a really long time, so it's like safe.
Yeah.
It's not getting, you know, if you don't keep it in a basement or keep it in wild fluctuating temperatures,
sure.
it's safe. So that's better than nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So then eventually people started giving us more and more stuff. And we just, you know, the librarian would do what she can and put scripts on the shelf and catalog them. So we have about 40,000 individually cataloged scripts in our library collection.
Mm-hmm.
And then the archival collections are like maybe between 100 and 150 individual writers
okay.
who have donated over the years. And it could be just like one box or it could be 20 boxes. It
mm-hmm.
just depends. And then in 2011, 2012, there was a woman, my predecessor, who actually was in grad school as well and was an intern
mm-hmm.
under the librarian. And she was like, you guys really need to have a professional archivist, a trained archivist, somebody
mm-hmm.
somebody who's focused only on that, somebody who's, that's
okay.
their job. Because,
sure.
You know, it's one thing for one professional librarian to say, I'm going to do all these things, but there's not enough time in the day to get it all done.
Sure.
So they, you know, got some money from different sources and went to the Writers Guild and said, hey, this is what we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then she, so she started and she was the first archivist and got the archive going and injected that energy into it and then brought me on and I started part-time originally and then she left at some point a few years later and I took over
mm-hmm.
and that's it.
Is it all...
We're very, like, small but growing, young but growing.
Right. Is it all? Is there any digitizing, or is it only cataloging, or is it a mix?
That is a good question, because everybody wants everything digital.
Sure.
Right now, actually, one of my interns, my summer interns, I have a lot of interns. That's how I get things done.
Sure.
She is going through and digitizing a lot of the old recordings on audio cassette.
Awesome. Okay.
Of, like, of WGA events and WGF events where the writers are talking about what they do. And a lot of times it's writers who are not also directors and actors who are, like, because those people get interviewed a lot about things. But I mean, like, the writers, the actual, you know, people in the writer's room. And so I'm digitizing a lot of that media because paper does last a long time and it's not machine readable. You don't, you know, you can look at it with your eyeballs and somebody in 500 years, you know, if we're still here and the United States exists, we're going to be able to read that still in English. Versus media content, media recordings that are on obsolete media.
Right, right.
So I digitize things when I am helping a researcher, but it's just on an as-needed basis. But now all of our scripts that we get from current shows and current films are all digital.
Right. That makes sense. Okay.
So, and that's actually a really cool thing. I'll show you. When we go into the library, I can show you how we provide access to those.
Okay.
Because they're not online.
Right.
But they are digital. And everyone's like, well, what does that mean? So I'll show you.
Okay. So we had originally talked about, we talked about this before I started recording, but I had originally contacted you about Bob Booker.
Right.
But you did say, essentially, that what you have of his archive might bore me. So, and that's,
right.
That's not how you put it. But it wasn't related to any
it's
of the comedy
related,
albums.
It's not related to comedy albums.
But you do have a comedy writer, pardon me, whose work that you're working on now. Can you talk about it?
And that is Mel Tolkien, who's one of my favorite writers and one of the most researched guys that we have here. I feel like there's been several international kind of research requests about him that I've had. So I want to get him out into the world, which is happening right now. So Mel started, he was born in the Ukraine. Mel was the first collection that I worked on, so I feel very close to him.
Okay.
And he's a person to me, and so I call him by his first name.
Of course.
He was born in the Ukraine and then moved to Canada, and he his parents wanted him to get a good, solid job, so he told them he was studying accounting, but really, he was going off at night, and he was writing music and, like, performing.
Oh my
God. And he didn't tell them until he actually thought he could make a go of it. Then he told his parents that, you know, sadly, I'm going into entertainment, and that's what I want to do. So he worked at this, he got a job working at this place called Camp Tamamint in the Poconos, which I guess is like the camp in Dirty Dancing. That's kind of what
makes sense. Yeah,
somebody,
like
I read that somewhere or something. So he got a job writing, you know, writing skits. And there's a guy named Max Liebman who, I don't know his history, but he found Mel Tolkien through that camp. And he's a producer. I think it was a Broadway producer.
Okay.
And he was looking to do a TV show. So he hired Mel Tolkien as his head writer. And there was a woman who Mel worked with named Lucille Callen, K-A-L-L-E-N, and she was the other half of the pair. And so they were the head writers on Your Show of Show. Or no, I'm sorry. First it was Admiral Broadway Review, which only lasted one season for some reason.
Okay.
And then the kind of staff from that went on to do this new show called Your Show of Shows that was Max Liebman, and the stars were Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca. And Your Show of Shows had a wonderful roster of sketch writers like Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks and Neil Simon and Danny Simon and wonderful other people. So this is, these are the, here, I guess we can set it like right here on this table.
I'm trying to figure out how you position this thing so it makes sense. Oh my
God. So these are all the playbills, I guess you call them.
Oh my God.
Even though
it's
not a play. So Max Liebman presents Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca, Your Show of Shows, and it's the rundown of sketches for that night and mm-hmm. like who, if there's a special guest star. Mm-hmm. So we've got all of the, we've got most of them, I think, for the episodes.
Holy crap.
And this show was only on for a few years.
Is it weird that I'm focusing on the fire notice by the fire commissioner on the upper hand,
no,
left-hand corner?
Absolutely
I'm just, that
not.
Little weird stuff is
focus on whatever.
Right?
I know. I mean, even just, like, the layout of it is cool.
Yeah.
And the,
yeah.
you know, the artifactual mm-hmm. nature of it. And
these
the,
are in
this
really
little,
good
like,
shape.
Drawing back here of
mm-hmm.
the stage.
Mm-hmm.
They are in good shape. Yeah. Well, he kept them. And I think his, she was saying the wife, his wife, Mel's wife, was mm-hmm. very, like, very organized about everything, and
mm-hmm.
I think wives do play a large part in
yeah.
In archives. Oh yeah, so then we move into the cream-colored ones.
Oh, all right.
And the embassy executives and the rundown for the night. See Mel Brooks, Danny Simon, Tony Webster, mm-hmm. Doc. That's Danny, Joe Stein. Yeah. Oh, Charlton Heston's
Holy
guest starring that week.
Love
that's
it.
Cool.
Love it.
And I don't know. This was a very popular show,
mm-hmm.
so I'm assuming that much of the audiovisual content was saved over the years. But with early
mm-hmm.
TV, it's always like it's hit or miss.
I know.
I got a donation. There's a guy whose dad was a prolific TV director
mm-hmm.
named Hal Cooper, and he
mm-hmm.
worked on many, many awesome TV shows in the 70s and 80s, but he began life writing for this children's television show that he created with his wife at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so this son called me up recently and said, I have all the scripts from this TV show. Do you want them?
Uh-huh.
Even though, like, his dad wasn't, you know, a writer as such.
Sure.
And wasn't, like, I don't know if he was a member of the Writers Guild or not, but he's got all these scripts of this show called The Magic Cottage, which was a kid's show, and I haven't quite figured out, it involved a lot of fairy tale
okay.
storytelling, and she would draw on a big, like, white easel paper or something. I
mm-hmm.
haven't quite figured out or visualized what the show is or how it appeared on screen. And according to the Wikipedia page, anyway, there's only two episodes of the show in existence.
Oh.
One copy at the Paley Center and one at UCLA
mm-hmm.
Film and TV Archive, because it was 49 to like 53
oh,
or
sure.
something, and
so
it was
cinemas or whatever.
It was it was kinescoped,
yeah, yeah.
and so nothing survived but two episodes. And now I'm like, oh, I have every script here from.
Yeah.
I mean, mostly pretty much every script, and it was on 5 days a week for half an hour.
Holy cow!
So, and they were actually all super organized and in file folders for each week,
that's
which
amazing.
Was awesome. So now I'm gonna put that online or make it known that I have the, not
yeah,
the
yeah.
collection, but
sure.
the collection description online,
mm-hmm.
and maybe people will be interested in The Magic Cottage.
That's so good.
Yeah.
I love it.
And on and on and on. And I don't know what people are going to be interested in, but I can guess,
mm-hmm.
and I can
mm-hmm.
do my best to anticipate.
Mm-hmm. Angela Lansbury was a guest on the last
oh.
episode, by the way. And there's Vera Lynn this episode. Holy cow. We're still only in 1954. You also kind of forget
we're getting
how
into
frequently
the
they did episodes back then.
Too. Oh, yeah. They were. It was like, I don't know. It was a factory. It was
mm-hmm.
a factory. And we've gotten into the Mel Brooks era when he was on the staff.
Mm-hmm.
Your show of shows went
mm-hmm.
off the air,
mm-hmm.
and then
was this the replacement?
They got the gang back together,
mm-hmm.
and there was the Caesar's Hour, and there was the Imogene Coca show,
mm-hmm.
I guess it was called.
Okay.
I don't know why. I haven't read the book. There's a book that's about the history of the show. I haven't
mm-hmm.
read it. But,
I should have, too, but that's okay.
So here's the... This is the...
Oh.
45?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a 45.
I don't know any records.
Wait, does it say...
It's in good shape.
This has record preview, so this is a demo version, I'm
not
assuming.
For sale.
Holy
not for sale.
Shit. Okay.
You, the A side is... Which side is the A side?
Good question. What
does it say?
I'm trying to see if it says it on here.
Since
it's a demo, it might not be clear.
Record preview. P-R-E-V-U-E.
Mm-hmm.
In the fashion. So, the three haircuts. That's right. I watched the clip online of the three haircuts,
mm-hmm.
and it's Sid Caesar, Carl Reiner, and Howie Morris. Singing Going Crazy, and mm-hmm. then on the back side or on the flip side, You Are So Rare to Me, which is just Sid mm-hmm. Caesar singing, I think. Oh, no, that one's The Three Haircuts, too. And so Mel Tolkien, I believe, is lyricist mm-hmm. on these or has lyric credit. I don't think he did the music. There's not yeah. that much music. They're basically,
right.
it's basically a cappella, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's so, phenomenal. Yeah.
I haven't, obviously... thought, I wonder if these got made, or if this is just its own thing. I wonder. Have you looked it up?
Well, so I wanted to see if it was, you know, if it existed in digital form, if somebody mm-hmm. had it. Because yeah. if nobody, you know, had done anything with it, then mm-hmm. I would consider, what can I do with it?
Or who
can I give it to be digitized? How can I make it happen? Sure. But I did find a couple of YouTube clips of when they did it on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was an audio that somebody uploaded. And I don't know if it was audio of this.
Right.
Or if it was, I don't know.
Huh.
You'll tell me, you'll research it.
I will absolutely dig, because that's amazing.
MGM Records, the greatest name in entertainment.
Even the sleeve is nice. Well, that's because it's the original sleeve. Sorry, I'm a nerd.
It's in really good shape.
Yeah, it's in really good shape.
So your show of shows mm-hmm. was the inspiration for the Dick Van Dyke Show,
mm-hmm.
which was created by Carl Reiner.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
right?
Yes, indeed.
And when they talk about a great comedy writer's room and just, like, everything gelling and everything being awesome, it was this writer's room.
Yeah.
And they have spoken over the years, all the kind of members of that staff have spoken over the years about the, you know, the level of, like, respect and appreciation that they had for each other and the how well they all worked together and played off each other
mm-hmm.
and the lack of ego at the time. So it sounds like kind of a magical... era.
For
and
sure.
And I enjoyed learning about it. And then Mel he worked on other TV shows. I mean, that was kind of the golden era. And mm-hmm. then he worked on other TV shows. His career ended. He worked on All in the Family. That was one of the last things he worked on. And that was, of course, a really interesting experience. And Mel Tolkien wrote a memoir of his life, and he never found a publisher for it, but I've got it here in the archive.
Holy cow.
And so it's really useful for people who are researching... I mean, he basically has, like, a little chapter on everybody. He has a chapter mm-hmm. on Carl Reiner and a chapter on Mel Brooks and Norman Lear and all these mm-hmm. great people. So so Mel's archive has been useful, at least in relation to those other more famous people.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I have to assume you've, this is a side thing, but I assume you've seen My Favorite Year, the movie.
No.
What?
I'm terrible.
It's fine.
I'm
not
terrible.
Everybody
I haven't
has.
Seen, like,
no, it's
half
a movie
of the
most people don't
I'm
know about all the
seeing.
Time. It's about, it's essentially about, like, have you seen Perfect Strangers? The TV show?
Yeah.
Okay. So, what's his name? Wise Mark Lynn Baker, who plays Larry Appleton.
Yeah.
He plays essentially Mel Brooks. He basically plays.
Right.
Yeah. So, I love Perfect Strangers. Sorry. That's a totally side thing. We talk about a separate time. I have a question about Perfect Strangers for you when we're done recording. But, it's basically about Mel Brooks being a writer.
Yeah.
And it's a very fanciful version of Mel Brooks being a writer.
Right.
It's him and Peter O'Toole playing basically Errol Flynn. And
right.
Joe Bologna plays King Kaiser. It's great. It's phenomenal. So it's worth looking at. If you like your show of shows. It's a fake your show of shows. And it's great. It's a brilliant movie. Very fun.
I do have... when your show of shows was on the air, the network, I guess, decided to release a few novelty albums from songs that they had written that Mel was a musician originally and mm-hmm. had been in, I believe he played the glockenspiel in the Canadian Army Band.
Amazing.
I want to say that that's what I read in his biography.
Awesome, okay.
So he was naturally a songwriter, or lyricist anyway, and so he's got co-credit on a few of the funny songs that they wrote mm-hmm. on your show of shows, and they're really great, and we'll look them up later.
That's awesome.
One of them's called Going Crazy, and those are the only words.
That's it.
And it's just, it's these are going crazy for a girl.
That's fantastic.
So, yeah. So he's one of our cooler people.
That's pretty
probably
fantastic.
The coolest.
It's got to be nice though, because if you get, I don't want to say obsession. That's what I call it when I talk about comedy stuff. What's your word for stuff that you're really heavily into, like Mel Tolkien?
Oh, what's my word for it? I get a little bit obsessed at that time, mm-hmm. but I have to move on because I have so many other people that I have to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do. I do get a little bit obsessed. Like, at night, I'll tell my husband about the things I learned that day.
Sure.
And, oh, this cool thing happened, and this person knew this person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's fun. And they do feel, like, real to me. Or at least if I'm the one who's kind of stuck with it, like, gone from beginning where it's a bunch of messy boxes, mm-hmm. all the way through the end, where I have written a collection guide and I've put it online, and then a researcher, somebody out of the blue, emails me and wants to know about something.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get that whole experience. That's the, like, that's the holy grail, I guess.
It's pretty great. So do you then arrange it for people to come and just take a look at whatever they want, or whatever you can provide, or?
I am very, like, we're very easy and accessible. Mm-hmm. I don't, we're so small. I'm just happy that people even know we exist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
small and new and not, like, affiliated with university, which is where you see
right.
most archives. So, I do my best to just make myself available. And so I have inventories on everything, or at least that's my goal, is to have inventories on everything.
Sure.
So that then people can tell me specifically what they're interested in, and I can get that if it's off-site. I just sit you down and let you go through and be excited.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
You don't have to mess with white gloves here, I'm imagining.
No, I do not do that.
Good.
I do not do that. White gloves are more for photographs,
mm-hmm.
I believe,
mm-hmm.
and we don't have too many photographs, and it makes, I mean, I feel this is true about me, and I think this is becoming more commonplace in general at
mm-hmm.
archives. It makes your dexterity much lower,
I
and so
that,
you
yeah.
can't, like, pick up the piece of paper.
So
you
might
you
ruin
wanna,
it in the process, right?
Right, like,
yeah.
you don't want to rip it. So, I think it's, I don't know. And every archive is going to be different.
Sure,
and
sure.
I'm a recently trained librarian and archivist, and so I'm very new school, and I don't
mm-hmm.
have 20 years of practice
mm-hmm.
the way we used to do things in the old ways. So I just kind of have to make it up as I go along, because we haven't done it here before,
right.
really, in a lot of ways.
No, I wasn't recording when you showed me. There's literally a shelf of typewriters. So I get why people give that to you. What becomes the purpose
know.
Of it? What do you do with it?
I know.
I mean, I could stare at those for a while, but...
They kind of like, they take up space, and they're big,
mm-hmm.
but they're cool looking.
Right.
But it's not like looking at somebody's typewriter is going to reveal their inner
right.
thoughts to you. I use them in exhibits.
Yeah? Okay, that's perfect. Okay.
We do, we have an exhibit space in our hallway. There's little 6 museum cases out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could put a typewriter in there just because you want something. One of my frustrations here is that, like, everything is white paper and it all looks the same.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's not true
sure.
100% of the time, but it's like, oh, it gets a little boring to look at sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I can put in a typewriter out there. Or we have college students who come into the library maybe about, like, 10 to 12, 15 visits a year. We have colleges. Usually, it's usually ones that are interning, like the students are interning here for the summer or
mm-hmm.
for a semester. They do their LA semester. And they come to our library, and we just, you know, welcome them and say, hey, we're a resource. If you move to LA after film school, come and, you know, we're a free place for you to come work.
Yeah.
So I do a tour and put out some archival artifacts, a little bit of history of the union and various writers, you know, papers, whatever is interesting to me on
mm-hmm.
that day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I'll put a typewriter out there because they've probably never seen one.
That's
I had never really seen one before I
mm-hmm.
started working here.
Right.
So.
I wouldn't have thought of that, but that makes perfect sense.
And just, you know, just kind of, that's the education arm of just, like, educating students, you know, saying, hey, look, it doesn't fall out of somebody's brain perfectly formed. It's not brilliant when it comes on the page. You are going to have a lot of drafts and cross outs and
mm-hmm.
and mistyped and things and you know, it's work.
Yeah.
And so that's what one of the educational missions that we try to do here. So as much as possible, I'll try to, besides just having the scripts, I'll try to show people relevant pieces of ephemera that relate to the person that they're reading.
Yeah. It's good to know this exists. It's annoying I didn't know it existed before, though. You know what I mean? Like, it's really too bad.
Well, up until 5 years ago, nobody was doing any outreach of any kind.
Sure.
So, and that's something that in library and archive circles, everybody talks about how important it is. And I don't know if it used to be important, but it's certainly important now. And if something's not online, then it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Which I kind of fall into myself because I'm a millennial or ish, mm-hmm. millennial-ish. So we do put stuff on Twitter when it's interesting.
Sure.
And if there's a screening that's relevant to a writer whose collection I have, I'll mm-hmm. like reach out and say, hey, I'll come exhibit some stuff at your screening.
That's awesome.
But it's just like, it's very word of mouth. It's not the kind of thing where I can just like put up a web page and, you know, show everything cool and just
right.
have people come to me. It's very word of mouth and very personal and very, very much like there's this discovery element
sure.
to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I don't know. How did you discover me?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because you asked me, like, how did you find out? And I was digging. I don't know. Here's the problem. I think I was on a research tip that I completely dropped after you and I started talking. So I need to hop back on whatever that was. But I was looking at Bob Booker, and I'm like, who has his archives? I think I want to read the scripts for his albums, is what I wanted.
Oh.
Because of my Von Meter, my interview with Von Meter's widow. So I've been trying to make these connections.
Do they have it at UCLA or no?
You know, I didn't dig. After you and I spoke, I didn't dig. I'm going to have to.
Bob Booker, I've got him and many of these other people at the Online Archive of California, which mm-hmm. is where the, quote, collection description is located. And
yes.
that is a portal that is a free portal for archives and libraries to use to put their collection guides online. But it's like one search bar to search across 200-300 California institutions.
Wow,
it's amazing.
Yeah.
And it was developed by the California Digital Library and it's hosted or done jointly with the University of California system. So I don't know why anybody wouldn't put their stuff on there. It's really awesome. And it's just this chance that, you know, you can search across all the institutions with one search.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is also indexed, I believe, by Google. So if you Google Bob Booker, mm-hmm. then those results will be a part
sense.
Of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So like before 4 years ago, there we didn't exist in there. So
mm-hmm.
it's amazing.
Yeah, I'm hoping at some point I can find some more, because the thing is, there's almost no one alive who was even on the album. I think one person, maybe?
Yeah.
And this is, like, the kind of digging I need to do before. Because the thing is, the bonus... Okay, but does it frustrate you? Because we were talking about this a little bit. People come right to you with stuff like, hey, do you want our crap? And you say, yes, I'll take your crap, I assume. But, like, has there ever been a moment where you're like, oh, God, I needed that, and it's gone? Like, you're not actively seeking it, and so you don't have to worry about it.
Oh, you mean, like, somebody who doesn't come to me and
mm-hmm.
some... I don't have time to seek out.
Right.
I really wish that I could.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have time because we have so many... I don't even get... It's not even so many donations, but I feel
mm-hmm.
like I've already gotten more inquiries and donations this year than I did, like, all of last year.
Really?
So, you know, and I'm just... It's just me and Arca and interns, and that's not... it's not ideal.
Sure.
Because there's that institutional knowledge and, like, you know, turnover. It's like constantly training people and stuff. So I have my hands full.
Yes.
So I don't seek out that much, although I want to start doing that. And I do have, not really. I mean, our foundation has relationships. Our foundation has been around for a long time. And so we have relationships with writers and I'm just happy if they like are donating somewhere. It doesn't have to be to me. I think that we're enough known now that people who are usually like after they've passed and the wife is like, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Usually she'll be talking to somebody and somebody will say, oh, what about the Writers Guild?
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll find their way to me. I feel like I don't know. I don't know if people haven't contacted me because I don't know about them.
Of course,
but,
yeah. So you don't have to worry about it. I'm just saying, with my OCD, if I had your job, my brain would be exploding all day.
Well,
I couldn't handle it.
I know. Well, I just don't think about it.
Good.
No, I have plenty of other things to think about.
Of course. What's your training like, or what's your degree in? I don't think we talked about that.
So I went to film school. I'm from Southern California, and I went to film school because I wanted to work in the movie biz and just, you know, live a dream life.
Didn't we all? Sure.
And like, and that didn't happen. But at some point in my late 20s, you know, I started thinking, what's going on here? What am I doing? Mm-hmm. What is my life going to be? And I had worked for a producer, and I had worked at a talent management company, so with actors. And my last job was working at a small lit agency, a boutique lit agency, which actually has come into play on many occasions at this job.
All right.
But, yeah, so I was like, and I always did want to help people in some fashion. And I realized that I really did love research, and I was really good at it. Mm-hmm. I've never been particularly like OCD about things being organized and I don't know, labels on everything. I'm kind of like bad about that, but I just decided for some reason, I fell into it, I guess. Yeah. I decided, why don't I try this grad school library thing and see what that's about? And immediately in the first semester, and I did an online program, and it's an online master's from San Jose State University. Mm-hmm. There's two programs in California. There's UCLA, which is a like full-time, like, you know, that's what you're doing for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do that because I couldn't afford to do that.
Sure.
So, and luckily my husband was, working, and we were like, we're fine. And so I could work part-time for 2 years while I did school. And I loved it. And I loved the people, and I loved the classes, and I loved what I was learning. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of made everything make sense. And it just felt so right. Mm-hmm. And then, I thought, I do like film history, and I like, the history of entertainment and the context and the threads that relate to everything. Mm-hmm. I'd always liked that and always like had been, you know, way into IMDb when it was first a website in the late 90s. I was all about that. Mm-hmm. And so then I got out of school and there's no professional level jobs for entry level librarians because there's too many librarians and not enough jobs. So I did a lot of part-time work, and my predecessor here, Joanne, knew that I had a film background because we had talked about that the first day we met, you know, because we all like find each other mm-hmm. and are attracted to each other. So she called me and asked if I wanted to do a part-time kind of fellowship mm-hmm. thing that was actually funded by the Phil Rosenthal Family Foundation.
Oh, amazing.
So I have Phil Rosenthal to thank, and his foundation has been very supportive of our archive and our foundation over
the
years. Yeah. Yeah. So,
Phil, if you're listening, you're a dream guest. Just so I can point that out. Continue. Apologize.
Oh, he's been such a great supporter of ours over the years. So, I was part-time, and then, the librarian who had been here for many years, she retired, and then mm-hmm. I got to be hired full time, and it's just been growing and expanding ever mm-hmm. since then. Yeah.
So, what is the day to day like?
And I didn't know anything about writers before I started working
that's
crazy.
Here. Well,
but now I do.
You know, the thing is, like, I went to film school too, and
writing was not on my radar. In film school, it's all about the, you know, what's on the screen and the directing and the whatever.
Well, that's just it. And I was a writer before I went to film school, and I feel like I so much about how to write when I was doing stuff that I did. Yeah. So, I got it. You rediscover the stuff that's important to you. Sometimes when you fall, like podcasting would be the closest I'm going to get to what you discover, and at least you get paid for what you do. So that's good.
Yeah.
I'm curious though, like, so how often are you given new stuff, and then how long does it take you to process an entire collection?
So, it's very unpredictable. Mm-hmm. Very unpredictable. There are, and this place is different from, let's say, like a really large university library or archive, because there's, you know, a lot of staff there, and people have specialties, and there's one person who does copyright, and one person who does donations, and one person who does, outreach, and there's somebody for everything, and all of that is me and my two colleagues in the library. So they spend most of, my two colleagues, Lauren and Javier, spend most of their day in the library helping patrons just on that everyday basis. And that takes up all the time because we're open 5 days a week to the public just on a walk-in basis. So then when I'm not, I used to help patrons a lot more and now I don't. And now I get to do actually more archiving. So there's processing of the collections, which is what I do the least of nowadays, I think. I think many archivists are that way. Actually, like, hands-on, like, getting your fingers dirty and the stuff. Because it takes a long time, and it's my administrative and managerial kind of responsibilities take precedence over that. And so that could take, you know, like, it could take, if it's a small collection, maybe we can get it done with, like, the interns, and maybe I can get it done, like, a month or two. Mm-hmm. Or it could take 6 months, or it could take 2 years, or it could kind of be minimally, what we call minimally processed, which is like a very top level summary. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you have to make decisions, and perhaps I'm giving away too many trade secrets here, but archivists have to make decisions about who is a priority and what they're, so each person will be different. How much detail do we go into? Are we just talking about a collection? Are we talking about a box? Are we talking about a folder level, which I don't really, well, maybe I do that. I do that sometimes if it's somebody like Mel Tolkien. Mm-hmm. So there's those different levels, and it's just knowing, you know, your organization and your, like, research requests, knowing, you know, being able to predict, like, what level do you need to go into for this particular person. So it's processing the collections, but then it's fielding research requests. And there's people who are researching aspects of WGA history. And so I do, essentially, I'm doing the research for them.
Okay.
Wow. Because I'm the most knowledgeable and I'm in the best position to be able to answer their questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, the job of a librarian or an archivist is to point people in the direction and give them the tools they need to do the research. And sometimes it's just easier for me to do it. So mm-hmm. I just, you know, we'll dig in and look for some correspondence from the 30s.
That's crazy. And that
doesn't, I mean, I get maybe, I don't know, a few meaty questions a month, maybe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, or if I don't have time, I'll ask my colleagues to do it.
What kind of questions are they? I'm curious. Like, what are people asking you that they think you can solve for them? And it sounds like you are solving these problems. I'm just curious.
Well, so there's two things. There's about specific writers. Like, somebody just contacted me on Monday saying is he in the UK? Maybe a guy in the UK who's writing an article or a chapter or something about Stephen J. Cannell, who was a prolific TV producer in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And we have an event that we did with him in 2006. And so I need to get it digitized and then give him access to that. So I haven't figured out how I'm going to do that yet. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing it. I'm working on that this week. Or somebody was asking once about writing. It's a lot about things that the Guild does, like writing credits or something that the Guild has always done since its inception and always wanted to do. And it's an important part of what we do. And so somebody might ask about, like, what was the process in the 1950s? And, I don't really know, but I know about the workings of the Guild enough to know kind of how to approach that problem. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of resources that other people don't know about, and so I'll point them to those. Or somebody, what was the guy? There was a guy in Finland who was researching Mel Tolkien. He was researching All in the Family, and so I helped him with the Mel Tolkien stuff, and he was in Finland, so I scanned some notes, some meeting notes, and gave it to him.
That's amazing.
Because I want the writer to be recognized, and I want them to have a voice, even though they're not with us anymore. I want them to be represented in the record.
It's nice that you don't, because the thing is, I think a lot of, in my brain, I think I'm doing, whether I'm doing it, I'm not doing it consciously, I'm conflating archiving with collecting, like what I do.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, there's a part of me that's like, you must have a collector's mind. But no, it's more.
I don't. You're not as precious about it. I don't, in fact. Like, no, and at home, I'm just like, throw everything away at home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, I wish I was that.
because I was trained in the. And archives in particular, archivists come from, or they used to be trained more in the public history, what's called public history background, and they would get MAs in history.
Okay.
And that's not me. And I'm trained in the MLIS, librarianship type. And so to me, and the way I was trained, it's like, what does the patron need? It's all about the patron. How are they going to search? How are they going to use this? How can I get it more accessible to them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's, and it is sometimes, and so there's the aspects of not just collecting, but there's also making it accessible to other people. That's the, like, other part of the equation
right. That's
different. I mean, if you had to make your collection accessible and, like, somehow make it known online, I mean, maybe you already do this, but, like, you were going to publish a, you know, a database online or something.
Right.
Like, you know, how do you do that?
Right, yeah.
So there's that aspect of it, the making, that's preserving, but it's making things accessible.
Yeah.
And so I approach that from librarianship, which is just, you know, get as much out there as possible or make it known mm-hmm. as much as possible. And, yeah.
Because collectors, and I count myself among them, and I try and stop it. After 7 years of doing this show, I'm trying to curb the bad habits. But, like, collectors are way too precious about this shit. And you just said,
I'm not precious about it.
I gave a guy meeting notes. And I'm like, when you said that, I'm like,
well,
you have meeting notes. It wouldn't even occur to me. And my brain's like, holy shit, that's so valuable.
But yeah.
Of course it is. But you're doing with it the only thing you should be done with it, which is give it to people.
Well, I made him sign a form that said that he would not, you know, disseminate it outside of his own usage.
Sure.
And he is, he's undertaking a scholarly study, mm-hmm. I presume, of All in the Family. Mm-hmm. And I think he was looking at the politics and, you know, probably race of it.
Okay.
And so that's why, I mean, to me, that's why our library and our archive exists, to support those, that historical research
mm-hmm.
and have the writer be represented. That's a big part of, I think, our Writers Guild Foundation mission, that's part of the reason why we were founded, which is have the writer, elevate the status of the writer and the professionalization of the writer
mm-hmm.
and the visibility of the writer. And so if this guy's going to write a thing about All in the Family, like, sure, I want Mel Tolkien in there. Like, I want him to be mentioned because
mm-hmm.
he was an interesting guy. And so, yeah.
Have you discovered... Have you, maybe not obsessed over anybody, but have you, like, discovered somebody you got extra interested in because you got their collection or something?
Yes!
Oh, who? Please.
I know, I was just thinking, I've talked so much about Mel Tolkien, let me talk about some other people. We were contacted, and this was while my predecessor was still here, my old boss, and she was contacted by this guy in Texas whose great aunt, or great grand aunt, I don't know what the relationship is, I forget, it was like his great grandmother's sister, I think, and he knew that she was kind of in some way related to the Screenwriters Guild, which is what we used to be called,
sure.
in 1920 when we started, or like super early days of loose organizing, and her name was Mary H. O'Connor, Mary Hamilton O'Connor. And he gave us a very tiny amount of like correspondence and some letters that she had written and some letters she had received, and there was like there was no information about this woman. There just wasn't anything. I mean, I have since discovered she basically wrote, you know, worked in the silent era and then just kind of petered out after that. And so there was no. You know, and she never married,
mm-hmm.
so she didn't have kids. She didn't have that legacy.
Sure.
Usually I think that's who keeps it alive is the kids and then the grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
She was never interviewed in any books. She wasn't ever written about at all. And so we had this stuff. And so I was tasked with, like, finding out as much as I could about her. So I ended up piecing together a biography from looking on Ancestry and even finding out who she was and looking up, like, a lot of newspapers have been digitized and they show up in Google results. And
mm-hmm.
so I pieced it together with that she was, like, in Oregon and Santa Cruz at one point. And she, And then there's a lot of old film periodicals which have been digitized and put online by this great group of people called the Media History Digital Library.
Okay.
It's awesome and free, and I just can't like speak of it enough. And I just put some old Guild newsletters on there. It's all full text searchable.
That's amazing.
It's got to be accessible.
Of course.
So I found Mary H. O'Connor, and she became my friend for a while, and I was kind of obsessed with her for a while.
That's amazing.
Definitely was obsessed for a brief time, and never found out much about her work or even her personal life, but she was active in our social club, which was called The Writers. Mm-hmm. And she was one of the things this guy, this relative gave us was the incorporation, I believe it's the incorporation documents, or I know there's a lease mm-hmm. from the clubhouse. They had this clubhouse. They leased this property on Sunset Boulevard, and she was so they formed a company, you know, for the purposes of renting that space.
Uh-huh.
And she was the majority shareholder, along with Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin, and a few others. But this woman had the most shares, so it's the stock holdings. And then I've got the lease from that leased it out to this corporation, the Sunset and Las Palmas Corporation. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, I've since discovered references to that clubhouse.
Sure, sure,
and
sure.
So that brings it to life for me. And I can kind of see how this woman was, you know, this was her thing. She liked being a part of the club, and yeah. she was involved. And at one point, I think very early on, was on the board of directors of the Screenwriters Guild. But then, I don't know why, just... You know, she seems to have disappeared by the mid-30s. But there was a woman here a few years ago who was looking for information about early female screenwriters. Mm-hmm. And it's now, you know, now, of course, we know more and more, and things are happening more and more in that realm of research. But she kind of saw this collection and thought it was cool, and I was really excited about it. So maybe that was infectious. And mm-hmm. then she wrote... a biography. She did more research and wrote a little biography of Mary O'Connor and put it on this website called the Columbia Women Film Pioneers Project, which
awesome.
Is just an online, you know, kind of encyclopedia of early female filmmakers and mm-hmm. their different crafts. So now Mary is on the internet and has a biography.
That's amazing.
You know, because I don't know, because we got a donation and it made it happen.
Yeah,
so
that's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And she would have disappeared because probably nobody ever interviewed her or gave a shit at the time. Because
yeah, I mean,
attention.
She
that
was just, you know, she was just a worker.
Right.
She was just a,
right.
And she never, I think it's because she never had kids and because she, mm-hmm. maybe she didn't know the right people. You know, it's like
yeah.
people get in with their friends and people are in certain cliques and mm-hmm. and they end up, you know, being the ones that drive the narrative or the story.
Right. God, that's so interesting. I it does now make me think, of course, which, like, what's out there that's falling
well,
apart and going away. But
well, you can't control that.
No, you can't. But, you know, at least people know how to reach out to you now. You know, that's
yeah.
a good thing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so good. I could.
I'll show you that stuff.
Please. That'd be great. I could talk to you about this all day, but I want to make
know.
Sure that you tell people... website, social media, and if there are any events.
So our website is wgfoundation.org. No A. People think there's an A in there. And on Twitter, we're at Writers Guild F. And we're also on Facebook. And we have a YouTube channel that has a lot of great videos of events from the, like, 2000s forward.
Okay.
And then we're on Instagram at WG Foundation as well. Our library is open Tuesday through Saturday to the public, 11 to 6, and on Thursdays we stay open till 8. Parking actually is not great
mm-hmm.
during the week, but Saturdays we have the building to ourselves, so
awesome.
Parking yeah. is available underneath the building. Our foundation, basically we take care of the past and the future. We are founded to preserve and promote writing. The Writers Guild Union, the administration, they handle like they handle everything having to do with guild labor issues and all that kind of stuff. And current guild members. And then we take care of, or, you know, our twin missions are preserving the past and keeping that alive and then educating the next generation. So we have programs two or three times a month. We have programs open to the public. They're ticketed. So it's like $15-$20. And that's one of the ways that we stay in business because we are getting revenue from tickets because we are a charitable organization. So our events are actually really awesome, and they're not, I think they're not, they're about writing, but I think they're more valuable to anybody who's not a writer. I think they're just valuable in terms of industry know-how and just, you know, just learning the lay of the land. And we had an agent manager panel. We actually sold out in like 2 hours and then had to add another session. And those were really great. We'll do something where we'll bring in all the writers of a TV show, of a writer's room, or at least, you know, a couple from the writer's room, and just interview them about what it's like and their process and stuff. Or we'll do a one-on-one with a more, you know, known person and, and just do a one-on-one about their career and about what they're working on. We have really good events. And it's and I do think they're valuable for, you know, they're about the craft, but they're also just about, you know, how does the business work, which really is what, like, everybody who is aspiring needs to learn about. And then on the archive side, we do, I don't do events. Occasionally I'll go to a screening or bring some exhibit items. We do oral histories. So I don't know if you've been to the Emmys interview, oral history interviews website. They, but we partner with them and with AMPUS, the Motion Picture Academy. AMPUS has done like 150 interviews, and Emmys has done like 870 interviews over 20 years, and those are all on YouTube with all kinds of TV crafts people and writers to executives to sound people, makeup, whatever. So we partner with them on oral histories, and so we're always trying to figure out who we want to get. And we approach those people and ask them. And so that's a fun thing. We always have events, so you can always look on our website to buy tickets online. I am going to be at the Archives Bazaar in October. Do you know what that is?
I don't. I don't, but...
The Archives Bazaar is a free event that happens every year, and it's all kinds of archives and libraries and museums around the Southern California region who all get together at USC on one Saturday in October to be super nerdy with
that's
each
amazing.
Other. It is. It really is.
Wow.
There's a consortium called LA as Subject, and it's basically a consortium of people who have an interest in LA history, which is basically any repository in the LA area, or, you know, like OC as well. And so this is the one day a year where we all set up our exhibit tables. We all get a table, and we're in the USC Doheny Library, which is a beautiful, old, fancy library. And it's open to the public and free, so it's really a chance for people who are collectors or researchers or who are really into one thing to kind of walk around and meet the archivists and the librarians who work at these places. And it's actually a really cool networking for us as well, because I want to know, you know, if I don't have all the cool stuff. There's other cool stuff out there. There's the baseball reliquary, and there's, of course, the Herrick Library from AMPUS, and there's the, you know, LA Firefighters Museum, and there's all kinds of cool places. So that is where I will be on October 20th, I think. It's like the second or third Saturday of October.
That's awesome.
And it happens every year in conjunction with American Archives Month, which is what the Society of American Archivists has deemed it, I think. October is like Advocacy Month. Like, if you don't do it all year long, do it in October. That's the goal.
Yeah, yeah.
So
Well, I have some nerds to tell about that, including myself. I'll just have to remember that because that sounds amazing. First of all, thank you. This has been super fun.
You're welcome.
Even though you guys are going to hear this out of order, we're going to go record some stuff. But we're going to pretend like we're ending the show here. You guys can, you know the places to check me out, but go to CelerySoundRecords.com. That's where you can maybe buy one of my comedy albums, or maybe buy Paul Dooley's comedy album that we just re-released, or maybe buy somebody else's. I don't care. Buy something. But that's about it. Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15-plus years.